month. One for Dad, one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be in Australia.
Dead, buried, cremated.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money's summer special series. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute. If you're taking a break this summer, but like me, you're still craving a political fix, we are here to help, giving you the best of from the Australia Institute's popular Politics in the Pub and other events from 2018. Since the 1980s, successive waves of economic reform have radically changed the Australian economy. We've seen privatisation, deregulation, marketisation, and the contracting out of government services such as transport and education. In the book Wrong Way, Australia's leading economists and public intellectuals look at these reforms and ask, have they been worthwhile? Have they given us a better society as promised? Senator Doug Cameron has a memorable Scottish burr and a lyrical turn of phrase, which he put to good use to launch the book Wrong Way, How Privatisation and Economic Reform Backfired. The Australia Institute's research fellow David Richardson joined Doug Cameron for the book launch, which was recorded live on the 20th of September 2018 at the Australia Institute's offices at The Level in Manuka.
Hello everyone, my name's Rachel Ball and I'm delighted to welcome you here tonight to this book launch. I'm the ACT Division Secretary of the National Tertiary Education Union. Possibly a slightly odd choice to be emceeing tonight's event, but I work with Damien Carl on the national executive of our union. When he's not co-authoring amazing books on neoliberalism, he's a union activist working for better conditions for our members in higher education. Yeah. Absolutely. Now, The Level, where we are, is a centre for civil society organisations in Canberra. Being located in the heart of our democracy here in Canberra, where a large part of the Fourth Estate reside, the public service is nearby and federal politicians just down that road. The centre gives a louder voice to those wanting to make a difference in the capital. I'm also very grateful to the Australia Institute for hosting this book launch tonight, and I think you'll all agree that this is such a fabulous venue. So, Doug Cameron, Senator Doug Cameron is with us tonight. He is probably a man who needs no introduction to this room, but that's not how these events work, so we're going to introduce him anyway. Doug was a union delegate for the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union. He's played a key role in industry policies in the manufacturing industry. He's been in federal parliament now for about a decade, so not long. Probably worked it out by now. In 2013, Doug was appointed a parliamentary secretary for housing and homelessness. And since being in opposition, Doug has been in the shadow ministry, including currently shadow minister for housing and homelessness and shadow minister for skills and apprenticeships. These are both areas that have comprehensive chapters in the book. And I think Doug will find that very interesting. Please join with me in welcoming Senator the Honourable Doug Cameron.
Well, thanks very much for that lovely introduction. And could I firstly acknowledge the traditional owners of the land and pay my respects to their elders past and present. It's a fantastic opportunity to launch The Wrong Way. And it's great to be here at the Australia Institute that does so much great work. And it's got to be, you know, amongst the most talented group of researchers we have. The Australia Institute has made such a big difference to how we consider neoliberalism and provide people like myself, you know, someone who left school at 15, the sort of arguments that I can run against the theoretical arguments, you know, of Hayek and the other, you know, terrible economists that are out there, you know. So I want to first of all congratulate Damien and Phil for editing such an impressive critique of liberalism, of neoliberalism. I want to acknowledge the contribution of the authors who collectively make a compelling argument for a change in direction from the economic orthodoxy that has delivered competition policy, privatisation in the self-described economic reform. I remember some time ago, I actually went into the dictionary and had a look at reform to see what it meant, because it wasn't what I was seeing, you know? And reform actually means to make things better. So how could what we have been putting up with be making things better? It just is not doing that. You know, unfortunately, reform under neoliberalism means increased inequality and the disempowerment of the unions and public institutions that exercise what J.K. Galbraith described as countervailing power. I mean, everything that is the power against the market has been deliberately targeted to detooth the union movement, to make them, you know, ineffective in relation to dealing with these issues. And not only have the neoliberals hijacked the word reform, they have, as demonstrated by Peter Brain, hijacked the economic modelling with the GCE model, the CGE model, designed so that assumptions and conclusions of neoclassical theory overrides the input of economic data. Peter's chapter ends with a clarion call for the restoration of economic models in line with scientific principles, or economics as a discipline will continue to be attuned to the interests of financial capital over ordinary people. You know, I just know that this modelling, you know, when I've been a critic of a long time of free trade, you know, we got all this modelling done and it was always so good, this modelling. And the modelling said that the GDP was going to increase. And then when you go back a few years later and you actually get the statistics, it never works. It never delivers. And I do remember one Treasury official when I was critical of economic modelling, when I was really giving a hard time, ended up saying, you know, it's better than asking your Uncle Fred. That was a Treasury official. So, you know, when you see economic modelling, come on, give us a break. You know, so, you know, Peter has said, you know, economic modelling actually used to deal with scientific principles and proper inputs. Now it's all gone. But given the growing disparity in wealth and income across the world, I don't think that this book could come at a better time. You know, Damien and Phil specifically describe the issues covered by this fantastic book, and I quote, "Since the early 1980s, Australia and its economy have been radically transformed by processes of privatisation, deregulation, marketisation, free trade agreements, and new approaches to macroeconomic policy focused on balancing budgets, reducing rates of income and corporate tax, constraining organised labour and targeting inflation." I think that's in a nutshell what this book does. And I want to say, you know, Phil's chapter entitled A Tale of Mandarins and Lemons, very good. It is good. Creating the market for vocational education and training is of particular interest to me as Shadow Minister for Skills, TAFE and Apprenticeship. Phil's work over a long period of time has advised and influenced my thinking on the problems of a market-based approach to vocational education and training. The commercialisation of vocational education over 30 years has resulted in a terrible and costly failure. And Phil outlines this in the book. What he says is competition has degraded quality and led to a massive waste of public and private money. It has led to the near destruction of the critical public institution TAFE and has damaged our capacity as a nation to reduce inequality and build the economy. Phil demonstrates convincingly that governments have no real hope of making and implementing good policy in a system driven by the market. The neoliberals continue to see the problem as one of implementation. It's just the implementation of this that's wrong. Well, they've been implementing neoliberalism for 30 years and we still can't get it right. Yeah? And they say, you know, governments have mismanaged the market. And you hear that all the time from those Muppets, You know, the Muppets that sit across from me in the Senate? I mean, when your own Prime Minister describes you as Muppets, you've not got a lot going for you, I've got to tell you. You know, Phil has made it clear that this is the wrong process. And it's the problems that are the design of how we're dealing with it through the market. The assumption that competition increases quality, Phil demonstrates is nonsense. And we've seen the creation of low-quality markets and the race to the bottom. The assumption that competition will optimise costs for consumers is plainly wrong. Under Vet Fee Help, wealthy students pay less for courses than poor students and non-Indigenous students less than Indigenous students. And even KPMG did a report recently that shows that, you know, the vet system that is getting declining income from government compared to the tertiary system which is getting increasing income, only 14% of working class kids go to university in Victoria and 60% rely on TAFE for their education. And that's the system that is getting killed by neoliberalism. So it's a clarion call, I think, in Phil's chapter for us to make sure we've got a decent vet system. And Labour has said clearly we will reinstitute TAFE as the anchor of the vocational education system in this country. You know, and the vocational education training system is seen as what is described as a valuable asset by private equity. And they don't want that to change. In fact, Justine, my researcher, pointed out to me something that I've used on a couple of occasions, and it's a quote from an investment advisor on the vet system. He says, this is an investment advisor, he says, education is a beautiful business when it works. Fat fees, hefty annual increases, recurring income, and high switching costs are just a few treats of high-performing education providers. Investors who have understood that sector's potential have done exceptionally well. That's our public education system getting killed by these greedy bastards. I also want to mention my good friend Jim Stanford's contribution, Fair Go No More, Neoliberalism and Australian Labour Market Policy. Jim's analysis of ABS statistics show labour compensation as a percentage of GDP falling from over 58% in the mid-1970s to just over 46% in 2017. It also shows the top income share of total income rising from approximately 4.5% in the early 80s to over 9% in 2014. So the rich are getting richer and working class people are getting poorer. That's the reality. No matter what the Productivity Commission says about inequality, this is the reality of inequality in this country. Now, I'm not as critical of the union movement as Jim is by the union movement adopting the accord process and establishing a social wage. I mean, I was part of the process. Maybe that's why I'm biased. You know, we felt at the time that it was important to improve health services, it was important to improve education, it was important to get superannuation, and I think the principles that the union movement applied in that period were good and right. But unfortunately, since then, the social wage has diminished and workers' bargaining rights have been hammered, and that's the problem. So I take the view that unions need to be an effective countervailing force, as in Jim's chapter. They need to be free of the artificial restrictions on their capacity to bargain and support their members. And once that happens, union density will increase. Because when I came to, I was in Musselbrook, I was a fitter at Liddell Power Station. You know that power station they want to keep going? I was a maintenance fitter there for 7 years. I lived in Musselbrook for 12 years, and I was a union official for 5 of my years in Musselbrook. Liddell Power Station was a heap of shit in 1975, and it's a bigger heap of shit now. Why we would ever keep that pollution going in the Hunter Valley, why we would ever think that coal is the answer, has got me beat. But there's one thing we need to do. We need to make sure that good working class people that have had a good living out of the power industry and the coal industry have got an alternative. And that alternative has to be renewable power and new jobs for the future. And if we don't do that, then we will fail. We will fail. So it's my view that when corporations are determining national bargaining strategies and implementing them across the country, and unions by law are proscribed from pattern bargaining, that's bullshit. It shouldn't be happening. If the bosses can bargain across their enterprises, why can't we? And as I said, when I came to Sydney, when I moved from Muswellbrook to Sydney, as a union official, I would go to mass meetings of MTFU members, Metal Trades Federation members, and there would be 15,000 workers at Redfern Oval listening to union officials outlining what they thought we should do to get their wages and conditions improved. That has stopped through enterprise bargaining. And in those days, if you had 15,000 members at Redfern Oval, you also had another 15,000 out at Leichhardt Oval. So you had 30,000 workers coming together collectively, knowing the strength of the union movement, knowing that if they were in a weak workshop, the strategies of people like Laurie Carmichael would make sure, the Metal Workers Union would make sure that the weak workshops would get a wage increase through the hot shop approach, driving increases in the hot shops and driving it across the industry. Those days, in my view, need to come back. Because if you're in a weak workshop, you'll stay weak in your wages and conditions. So we need a new strategy on this, and I say Labour has got an obligation to deal with that. So the balance has shifted basically to the bosses, and that's not good. And we face laws in Australia that no other OECD country faces. You know, you're restricted in what you can bargain. You're restricted in how you can bargain. You're restricted on right of entry. You're restricted on pattern bargaining. You've got the ABCC. Now you've got the ROC, the Registered Organisations Commission. And what's happening is the Liberals are planting in those areas. You know, they're attack dogs. Liberal apparatchiks are controlling these public areas. And that's how one of their control measures for neoliberalism, to control what's happening in public, supposedly independent public institutions. Now, I have to say to you, the chapter on aged care by Bob Davidson couldn't have come at a better time. You know, you look at what's happening there, you look at the issues that are a problem there, and you see how, you know, elderly people are being treated in these institutions. That has to change. And a Royal Commission, we agree, is an appropriate way to deal with it. Now, there's so many talented people have contributed to this book. People have helped me over many years. Jim Stanford, John Quiggin, Peter Brain. Sometimes I find it difficult to understand Peter's analysis. But that's another thing. That's because I left school at 15. You know, Pat Ranald, who's done a great job on trade, and I might just mention trade briefly. Dave Richardson, you know, fantastic guy here, a fantastic economist, great contributor. And Frank Stillwell, you know, have been significant influences on my political thinking. I just wish that they had influenced some of my comrades' political thinking as much as they influenced mine. We'd have a better country. There's no doubt about that. So this is a fantastic book. The chapter on trade, I just won't have to be a bit careful what I say on trade. You know, we've had a big brawl in the Labour Party about trade, and the brawl was a brawl about policy. And since I went to Seattle in 1999, remember the battle for Seattle? I happened to be there, and I think I met Jim Stanford in Seattle, and I've always thought that trade liberalisation needs to be understood better by people in this country. And what they need to understand is once you start integrating your economy, you start to integrate your social society. And that means there'll be more pressure on the social security system, there'll be more pressure on pensions, There'll be more pressure on the health system, more pressure on the education system. These are the issues that the wrong way has identified as the issues that we need to deal with. And I am really pleased that this book is out. I've got to tell you, over the last couple of weeks when I've had it, I've used it more like an information manual, you know, to go in and have a look at, you know, this issue and that issue. It's all there. I recommend this book to any progressive person in the country. It's got it all there. And you just have to go into those chapters to then understand why we've got problems in our economy, in our society, because of neoliberalism. This is a fantastic book. I just hope all of my comrades read it in the Labour Party. Yeah? But in saying that, I've got to tell you, I feel much more comfortable in the Labour Party these days than I did 20 years ago. We have definitely got a policy agenda that is progressive. We've got a policy agenda, I won't mention the TPP. We've got a policy agenda that is great on health, great on education. My view is that we will make changes in the industrial system to strengthen the capacity of the countervailing force, the union movement. My view is that we should be using organisations like the Australia Institute to provide us real independent economic advice, not those like the Productivity Commission, who are full of neoliberal economists who just don't care about that. And I think the worst thing that you can look at is argue that the Productivity Commission's not bad because they did the work on the NDIS. Well, you've got to get something right. You've got to get something right. But even that, the NDIS being, you know, focused on the individual, being focused on choice, being focused on competition, being focused on the privatisation of delivery, is going to cause us huge problems. So the Productivity Commission didn't even get that right, and I'm trying to convince, you know, many of my colleagues that this is a problem for the future. This is a fantastic book. It is a great resource for progressive politicians like myself. It's a fantastic opportunity to actually address the issues that are affecting working class people in this country. You know, all of the contributors are to be congratulated for what a great job they've done. This is a must-have book. It's a book that educates progressive. It's a book that analyses the issue. And it's a book that everyone should read. Well done, comrades. It's fantastic.
Well, I think Doug said everything there is to say. No, let's hear from the authors or the editors, as the case may be. I've got Damien Carl and I've got Phil Toner. Damien is an associate professor in political economy at the University of Sydney. Basically, he researches neoliberalism. So I think the lens that he's brought to this book is an expert one. Philip Toner is an honorary senior research fellow in the Department of Political Economy in the University of Sydney. I haven't asked them if their offices are just down the hall, but I suspect they are. Phil has done a range of research, way too long to read, and I hear that he has other things that he does as well. So I suggest talking to them after a drink as well, but I'd like to invite them to have a brief chat about the book.
Thanks, Rach. I should note there are a number of connections between the Australia Institute and this book. So Jim Stanton and Liz Hill, who are both authors of chapters in the book, they're on the board of the Australia Institute. Dave Richardson, an author in the book, is part of the Australia Institute. And Richard Dennis, who provided a really nice endorsement, is also part of the Australia Institute. I'm just going to say a few words about why Phil and I decided to put this together, then I'll hand over to Phil. So there are actually plenty of books around which over the years have critiqued privatisation and economic reform. Why have we decided to do this and why have we decided to do it now? There are three reasons, really. First, from the vantage point of three decades of economic reform, we now know what this process looks like and we can evaluate its concrete effects. Too often, as Doug said, dogmatic attachment to economic reform has obscured a sober analysis of its costs and benefits. The passage of time the fact that it's been with us now for three decades means that it's no longer plausible to explain away the negative effects of economic reform as a consequence of transitional problems. This is what the supporters of economic reform say. If there are negative effects, well, it's just a transitional problem. Over time, they'll be ironed out. Well, if you've been doing the same thing, as Doug said, for 20 or 30 years, we're not in transition anymore. We've arrived at the destination. We know what it looks like, and we can have a good hard look and see if we like it and see if it's found wanting. It's no longer plausible to explain away the negative effects of economic reform as problems of imperfect implementation. This is what you hear the proponents of privatisation and deregulation saying as well. It wasn't implemented in the right way. If we've got the model right, if only it was implemented according to the model, things would be rosy. But in fact, policies are always imperfect in a sense. And in the case of economic reform and privatisation and deregulation, what we've seen is that it's powerful private interests, oligopolistic markets, and states intervening on their behalf that constitute the reality, rather than the utopian or dystopian visions of economic theory, perfect competition, or government acting as some benign umpire. That's not the case. The second reason we wrote this book is that the institutions and the arrangements created through economic reform seems to me are now in crisis, here and indeed around the world. Since the global financial crisis hit in 2008, it's morphed into a more general economic crisis across the world. Since that time, in the capitalist economies, almost without exception, the advanced capitalist economies, we've seen anemic growth, deflation, low or negative wage growth, massive budget deficits. All of a sudden, policies that were the orthodoxy for three decades seem to have lost their efficacy. That's the second reason for writing the book. The third reason flows from this, and that is that as a result of the crisis, politics, it seems to me, has shifted. Doug alluded to this. Austerity policies, a general sense of economic insecurity, have combined with an increasing recognition of the unequal distribution of economic rewards, both before the crisis and since the onset of crisis, to generate disenchantment with mainstream politics, including with the neoliberal consensus. This has come from both the right, but also from the left. And while this political shift is perhaps most obvious elsewhere in the USA with the election of Trump, with the surge in support for Corbyn, for Sanders and the Brexit vote, we see it here as well, I think. We see it here in the leftward shift of Labor that Doug has talked about. We see it here when hitherto dogmatic supporters of economic reform seem to have changed their mind. So 2 years ago, Rod Sims, the head of the ACCC, Competition and Consumer Commission, historically a staunch advocate of economic reform, he came out in a speech and made a stinging attack on privatisation. He said, privatisation has led to unaccountable oligopolies, increasing prices, lowering of productivity. When someone like Rod Sims comes out and says this, it's clear that a shift is afoot. When former Liberal Treasurer Peter Costello comes out and says we should have a nationalised default superannuation fund, it's clear that something is going on. Things that were unthinkable, unspeakable, just a few years ago, are now part of the mainstream agenda. It strikes Phil and I, that this major political economic shift that's going on means that it's time for re-evaluation of policies that were mainstream just a few years ago. Time to think about and evaluate the costs of economic reform in Australia. So just to wrap up then, this book is motivated by the ambition to bring evidence to bear on what has often been a highly blinkered and ideological policy discussion. It's driven by the need of what we see to seize the window of opportunity presented by the ongoing economic crisis and to evaluate what many people intuitively feel has, at least some respects, been a highly wasteful policy agenda. We think in putting this book together, it's time to take stock of the concrete effects, the concrete legacies of policymakers' more than 30 years' attachment to economic reform, market fundamentalism and neoliberalism. What have been the costs? Have they been worth it? What are the policy alternatives? It's time, we think, to intervene in public discourse and carve out a new meaning of economic reform. Thanks.
Yeah, look, I'll be really quick. How is it possible for any reasonable person to criticise the outcomes of economic reform over the last four decades? Is there not consensus within mainstream economics, politics and the financial press that the bountiful fruit of reform is 27 years of unbroken economic growth. Who could possibly question this? Loser lefty leaners, not real lifters? Carping communist cadres? People who get their fake news from The Guardian and real news from the Batuta Advocate? Over the last four decades, orthodoxy has fashioned an economic creation myth as powerful and all-explaining as that of the rainbow serpent and Genesis combined. Hawke and Keating delivered their people from backwardness and false belief by putting over 100 years of unique Australian institutions to the sword. They started, but certainly did not finish, the process of privatisation, contracting out remaining government services, restricting the growth of tax revenues, and distributing budget surpluses as if they were company dividends through cuts to income and corporate tax rates. Those owning more shares in the national capital stock got more dividends. Deregulating capital markets, floating the dollar, enterprise bargaining, anti-union laws, replacing industry assistance with so-called free trade agreements, and ensuring senior bureaucrats are brought to heel by placing them on short-term employment contracts. In particular order, what have been the main outcomes of economic reform? One, increased private market power through creation of private monopolies and increased industry concentration. Think ports, airports, electricity grids, toll roads, rail freight, gas supply, retail, insurance, banking. Two, an exchange rate that does not control external imbalances but worsens them and undermines investment in non-commodity trade-exposed sectors, especially advanced manufacturing. Three, growing resource dependence and an economy and tax receipts substantially hostage to commodity prices. Four, an industrial structure that generates many low-wage, low-productivity jobs. Five, a record of poor productivity growth. Six, rising income and wealth inequality. Seven, related to that, huge household debt and unaffordable housing. Eight, a large shift of national income from wages to capital without a commensurate rise in non-commodity investment. Nine, declining quality of public services. 10, a stuffed vocational and education training system. 11, in place of a coherent industrial policy focused on innovation, we have an economic strategy based on high population growth with damaging environmental effects and degraded urban life. One could go on. Upon retirement, Margaret Thatcher was asked what was her greatest achievement. She dryly replied, Tony Blair. Similarly, the greatest achievement of the former right-wing monetarist head of Federal Treasury, John Stone, who weaponised the new Labor Treasurer in 1983, Paul Keating, with neoliberal economic arguments. Keating's ignorance and arrogance made him a hugely dangerous and effective zealot for the cause. And what was Paul Keating's greatest achievement? Any guess? Barangaroo? Floating the dollar? This book.
Now, we actually have one of the chapter authors here tonight. I'm not quite sure. Dave, you're going to say a couple of things?
You got me. You got me. No, but look, thanks, Doug, and the editors of the book, and Rachel for being here today. This is a terrific achievement. To add to Phil's list, my little chapter's on foreign investment. And this is a topic that you don't hear much about anymore, unless it's the nasty Chinese want to do something. But just a couple of factoids. If you look up the membership of the Business Council of Australia, and we all know how influential they've been, you look up their membership, and there they all are, the Chevrons and Apple and everybody. You could almost say the BCA is a front for foreign capital. And the amounts are massive. In Australia, foreign investment at the moment, or the latest figures we had, is around $3.2 trillion worth. And, you know, big numbers, what does that mean? That's roughly twice Australia's annual GDP. Quite an incredible figure. And they want something for that. And we were warned by the Vernon Committee in 1965. But as a result of all this foreign investment in Australia, Australia's national income, this is the income that accrues to us, is reduced by some $150 billion per annum. That's worth reflecting on. Now, when Abbott won government, he was able to announce that, you know, it's now open door for foreign investment. But it wasn't always like that. And he's reflecting perhaps the really crude version of neoliberalism, which basically says whatever the market does is okay. But I still have in my possession a monograph that Treasury wrote in 1972 on foreign investment. And it starts off, "Are the economic benefits of finance capital sufficient to outweigh the gains it reaps from Australia?" It's worth reflecting on those words, the gains it reaps from Australia. I put it at roughly $150 billion. But I've had arguments with the ABS while I was writing my chapter. I quoted a particular figure for foreign investment in the Australian stock market and a few other things. And in the period when we were asked to, you know, revise the chapter or, you know, make any changes we wanted to, I looked up the latest, some new latest figures, and there was a $200 billion difference. So I now no longer have any confidence in the actual figures that I quote, although they're the latest and they're official, but they give us the orders of magnitude. Foreign investment in Australia is huge and it's not benign, and we should have a much more critical attitude to it.
And that was Dave Richardson from the Australia Institute, where he's worked for the last decade. And I love that Dave had an argument with the ABS. That shows you the calibre of the researchers who've worked on this book. So we've gone a little bit over time, but I thought it was worth it. We've had some excellent speakers. I'd really like to thank Senator Cameron. I'd like to thank Damien Carl, Philip Toner and David Richardson. I'd like to thank the Australia Institute for hosting us, and particularly a personal note to Anna, who helped me, and Alison, who helped me a lot with the tonight. That was great.
That's a summer special episode of Follow the Money, brought to you by the Australia Institute. And a very big thank you to Senator Doug Cameron and the Australia Institute's Senior Research Fellow, David Richardson. Wrong Way is available to buy online at blackinkbooks.com.au. If you live in Canberra or are visiting and want to see one of our Politics in the Pub live events, sign up on our website at tai.org.au. You can listen free to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you download your favourite podcasts. And if you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and leave a rating on iTunes. It helps other people to find it. You can find the Australia Institute on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. And you can find me at Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Listen free to Follow the Money wherever you download your favourite podcasts. Politics in the Pub is recorded live by Clayton McDonald. And this episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, with additional editing by Andrea Cantle. Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum composed our title track, and you can find more of his music at pulseandthrum.com. Thanks for listening.